Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing from one of the great swimmers of our time, Diana Nyad. In part two of today's program, you'll hear about the Racine Theater Guild's current production of Little Shop of Horrors. Its final weekend of performances begins tonight. I am talking with a superwoman today, Diana Nyad, and I'm sure many of you are well aware of her extraordinary story. Regarded in the 1970s as one of the finest long-distance swimmers in the entire world, going on to a very, very distinguished career as a broadcaster and journalist, and then returning to marathon swimming or long-distance swimming in a very, very spectacular fashion, culminating in an accomplishment at the age of 64, when she managed to swim from Cuba to Florida, 111 miles in the open ocean, an endurance feat like none other ever accomplished. She talks about that and much, much more in an exceptionally fine, compelling memoir called Find a Way, the inspiring story of one woman's pursuit of a lifelong dream. And the book explores all kinds of facets of her life and her professional careers. Published by Vintage Book, a division of Penguin Random House. Diana Nyad, we welcome you to the morning show.
My goodness, Greg, I need to get you onto my public relations team. That was a sterling introduction. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And by although
I don't deserve it, I really don't.
Well, and I neglected to mention something that's of special interest, of course, to many of our listeners, which is that among the many things you've done is quite a lot of distinguished work for National Public Radio. So I know a lot of people feel like they know you just from the sound of your voice. One of the things
I might say that in the 30 years that I wasn't a swimmer, you know, I didn't swim a stroke from 30 to 60, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. I picked back up on this, you know, epic dream of mine of swimming Cuba to Florida when I was 60 years old. But in that 30 years, I'm not going to complain. I worked for the wide world of sports. I was traveling, you know, Fox Sports. But NPR, that was the cream of the cream. And I may go back to work for them at the moment. So you are with the cream of the cream, and you are the cream of the cream. So I'm honored to be with you.
Well, very good. Glad we can talk, and glad we can talk about your marvelous book. It is, of course, more than anything, a book about your extraordinary accomplishments as a swimmer. One of the things I appreciate about the memoir is that it is such a deeply personal book, and yet you also give great attention to sort of the technical details that are behind this kind of swimming, and in particular, the extraordinary teamwork that is essential in order to accomplish what you have, in particular, this epic swim from Cuba to Florida. I wonder if you could just say a word about, as you crafted this book, how much did you think about what facets of the story were the most important to tell? I mean, it's not an easy life to summarize.
You know, it is, and I don't think anybody's is. You know, I don't care whether you've, you know, earned a bit of a moment as a public figure or if you haven't. If you sit down at the age of 64, and that's when I started to write the book, I'm 66 now, you've lived a long life. You've gone a lot of places, met a lot of remarkable people. And what is the story? I mean, there are many, many people called memoirists, and they write their memoirs of many different eras of their lives. Well, you know, I didn't want to go to what they call cradle to grave. I was born on this day, and I, you know, now I'm this age. But I did. I did struggle. Finally, I knew the Cuba swim. You know, that was the momentous, dramatic saga. You know, that was sort of the center and the metaphor for my life of living large, never giving up, chasing some impossible dream. So that was clear that was going to be there, and that was going to drive the narrative. But then you've got a family, and you've got friends, and you've traveled the world, and you've worked in extraordinary places. And I struggled with, you know, does anybody really want to read all of this stuff? I guess Bill Clinton, when he turned in his first memoir to Knopf, I think it was something like 1,000 pages, and they said, Bill, you can't tell every story that's ever happened to you. He said, I can, I did, and that's what we're going to publish. I didn't think I could get away with, as much as what Bill Clinton could get away with, so I tried to pick and choose.
Well, I think you chose very well. It's an incredibly compelling book. And, of course, it's ultimately an inspiring book of triumph. But there are, of course, dark, painful moments as well. You write at one point, I've lived a life of overwhelming privilege and opportunity. Nevertheless, those crimes committed against me by my father and then my coach marked my interior world to a haunting degree. Just say a quick word about the kind of pain that we are talking about and the role which it played, especially for the first part of your life in terms of driving you in what you accomplished. Not that it's the sole reason for your accomplishments, but it's certainly a factor.
Yeah, you know, Greg, as we know, you know, the human condition is to suffer. Every human being goes through heartache, you know, comes up against obstacles. You don't get through life and, you know, get to be, let's say, 80 and say, you know what, the whole thing was a bowl of cherries. I just never had a problem in my life. So my cross to bear was being molested by two, you know, parental figures. One was literally a parent, and the other was the one who was going to take up the slack for that parent's ill doings, my coach. And to me, it's a despicable, heinous crime. You as a preacher, teacher, coach, parent, step-parent, you know, when you have a young person that you're trying to teach integrity and ethics and joy and send them out in the world with self-esteem, when you humiliate them and you frighten them, what kind of parent are you, the worst kind? And am I alone in this? I mean, we are looking at a damn epidemic. We're talking 1 in every 4 girls, 1 in every 6 boys in this country, and that's just the ones who talk about it. So, you know, the one thing I rail against, though, Greg, is I am not going to sit here and say to you, you know what, in some kind of twisted way, I'm grateful I had to go through that because look how tough it made me. No, Greg, I was that tough person. Before all of those molestations happened, I was pretty darn terrific, and I wound up finding that self again. So I don't like to give credence. I don't like to say, yeah, I became a driven person because of that. I won't go there.
Right.
I just say I would have gotten there, and I would have gotten there faster had it not been for those heinous crimes against me. But again, I'm glad you read the first part. Believe me, by far and large, it's been a joyful, privileged life. Believe me.
By the way, I appreciated how when you talked about getting so fervently, vibrantly interested in swimming, one of the things you say is, I think some of that sense of the unease of life was somewhat behind how you were attracted to the pre-dawn wake-up call for swimming. I thrived on the superior feeling of being awake when most of the world was still sleeping. because for someone on the sidelines looking from afar, I've always kind of wondered what the attraction would be to be up at those pre-dawn hours swimming and swimming and swimming. Of course, you had no idea what it was going to be preparing you for. When you write about leaving your broadcast career behind to resume swimming, I find it really interesting. You say that you began to feel, despite your gratitude for what you'd experienced, a mounting malaise of a spectator. I was a bystander witnessing other people chasing their dreams. So is that what brought you back into the water?
It was turning 60. It was that existential angst of seeing for the first time, a flicker of the end of this one-way road. We're all traveling. You don't see that at 30. You don't see it at 40. You get a little bit older. Your mother dies. You meet Christopher Reeve, who had his accident and became a quadriplegic, and you start, you know, kind of roiling around with, there isn't much time left. This whole thing is fleeting by. I want to live it large. I want to chase the most impossible star that's in my universe. And for me, that happened to be Cuba. You know, for me, Cuba was never another swim, ever. It was this emblem of being everything, touching every fiber of potential, dipping down into every drop of courage, and having a team around me who lived with that same passion of commitment. We were high on life, even when we weren't making it. Four failures, all public. We were on a journey that we found, you know, to be teeming with scientific discovery and noble friendship and the journey of history. And we may have never made it, and we still found the journey worthwhile.
Hmm. Talk for a moment about something you described briefly, that is the navigational complications that are involved in swimming from Cuba to Florida, beyond just that fierce distance, which, of course, makes it a prohibitive impossibility for most human beings. But talk about the special challenge involved in this particular journey.
If we were to lay out the navigational charts, the nautical charts of the Earth's surface. Now, let's not count the Arctic and Antarctic. We got to be someplace warm enough where you can survive for, you know, two and a half to 3 days. So, but in equatorial Earth and a little bit north and south of there, you can't find Mother Nature raging on steroids. You can't find a more difficult crossing for a swimmer than this particular 100 miles. Plus, between Cuba and Florida, it's the axis of the Gulf Stream, this mighty stream going five times your swimming speed, is going due east. You are going due north. And it took John Bartlett, our navigator, a virtual mathematical genius, to try to take the vector of my swim speed against that swim current, and every 15 minutes, point my vector a little bit, a hair this, a little more north-northeast, a little to the text now of north-northwest, and somehow help me get across. And I haven't even mentioned yet the sharks or the box jellyfish, the most potent venom on all of Earth. Most people die. I should have died when I was hit by the swarm of those guys. We're talking about eddies that swirl around counterclockwise within the Gulf Stream. Once you're in there, you're in a vortex. You'll never get out. We're talking about winds that are unpredictable, can fire up to 65 miles an hour in a 2 minute notice. So it is a vast, dangerous wilderness out there, like nowhere else on Earth as far as a swimmer goes. And masochistic or not, there was something appealing about that to me.
And of course, part of what's so interesting is only you were swimming it in terms of doing the actual swimming. But as you say, that you had this team around you that were doing essential work to keep this going, although there were very strict limitations on what they could do. And you had to yourself keep swimming or floating, but no one could assist you in that at all throughout this long, long journey. Say a word about the cardinal rule that you could not be told how far you had progressed. I thought this was really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's a foolish enterprise. You have so many unknowns out there, and of course you don't know what lies ahead. So let's just say that we have five boats, we have 44 people, the team is adept, it's deep, the top jellyfish expert in the world, top shark divers from the tropics are with us. I mentioned my navigator, Bonnie, my head handler, crack medical team from the University of Miami, emergency room doctors, sports med guys. You know, it's a big team, and then you've got an extended team around them who are taking care of them. So we have a flotilla. Picture it. There's an epicenter that's me and the boat I'm next to. But what if we, you know, somebody on another boat took a look at our GPS map and said, wow, This is fantastic. We're only 24 hours into it, and she's 55 miles from the coast of Havana. We're halfway. And what if that person, you know, is a loudmouth and gets on a bullhorn or comes over to my boat, and when I stop for my little feeding and I'm treading water, says, Diana, do you know we're halfway? Isn't this great? Well, we don't know if we're halfway. We don't know what current's coming. We don't know what shark's coming. We don't know what's going to happen to me and my debilitation, you know, of energy and glycogen as I go across. Until we see the whites of the eyes of people standing on the shore, we have not made that swim. You know, literally an hour before we finished, after swimming for 53 hours, I ran into a rash of jellyfish. It wasn't the box, but when you're tired and you've lost a lot of weight and a lot of energy and you get hit by a rash of the moon jellies, I went into a minor electric shock all over the body. That stupid little, you know, encounter with those moon jellyfish after 53 hours could have been the kibosh on the entire thing. So the cardinal rule is nobody ever tells me where we are or what time it is. We get to the beach when we get to the beach.
Well, of course, you got there successfully, and at the age of 64. One of the things you tell us is that you swam with anger and defiance until you were in your 50s. Do you think you could have achieved this at the age of 64 if you had still been swimming with all of that anger?
You know, I think that's a good point, and it mounts on with other points. I am a better athlete in my mid-60s, an endurance athlete anyway, than I was in my 20s. Part of it is that I was more calm. I was beatific in some ways, in awe at this blue jewel of a planet that we get to live on. I think, you know, would I have made it? It's like would have, could have, should have. Nobody ever knows. If I hadn't made it a fifth time, as a kid from PS 185 in Brooklyn asked me, would I have gone a sixth time? And I said, you know, we're lucky that's a moot question because I did make it and we don't have to go there.
But, absolutely.
I was better in every way.
Well, it's a joyous book, ultimately. Find a Way, published by Vintage Books, the author Diana Nyad. Diana Nyad, congratulations on all you've accomplished and on writing this marvelous memoir.
I so appreciate it, Greg. And may I say one last thing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is that, you know, I've read Steve Jobs and other people who have achieved their dreams, and they say one of the most important factors in achieving a dream is not resting on those laurels. So I'm very proud of the Cuba Endeavor. I'm proud of my team, but I can't sit around, you know, like Norma Desmond, pulling up the Cuba footage for the rest of my life. I'm going on to something, an initiative called Everwalk. Check it out, everwalk.com. Bonnie and I, my Cuba buddy, we are going to walk the epic corridors of America. We're going to go from Philly to D.C., Chicago to Minneapolis, Portland to Seattle, Boston to New York. We're going to walk all of the corridors with thousands of people. They say sitting is the new smoking. And after 5 years, we're going to walk from the Pacific to the Atlantic, and we're going to get a million people to do it with us, literally. So I urge you to come out and take a few steps with us.
Wow. So still living the fierce life.
I hope so. Always. Onward, as we say.
Diana Nyad, thank you again for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks a lot, Greg. Take care.
It's 8:29, time for part two of today's morning show here on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio.
Little shop, little shop, little shop, little shop.
And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm really excited to be speaking with my friend and colleague from the Racine Theater Guild, Kara Ernst. Actually, I just realized, should I be calling you something else?
That's fine. Technically, it's Kara Ernst Schalk, but Kara Ernst is fine.
All right.
It doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, great. Well, by any name, Kara is the choreographer extraordinaire here at the Racine Theater Guild, and also does a fair amount of directing now, too, in addition to choreography. And she is at the helm for the summer show at the Racine Theater Guild, which actually opened last weekend. So we are talking on the eve of the second and final weekend of performances of Little Shop of Horrors. And this is one of those shows where just the name evokes really strong feelings from a lot of people. This is one of those shows where there is a very intense sort of cult following. And so there are a lot of people, of course, really excited to take in this show. And I'm excited to learn more about it. This will be the first time I've ever seen Little Shop of Horrors on stage. So I've heard little snips of it, but I've never experienced the show in its entirety. So I'm looking forward to seeing it this weekend and looking forward to talking with Kara Ernst, the director of the Theater Guild's production. Kara, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
How weird does it feel to shift gears from the big spring musical, which was Fiddler on the Roof, to something like Little Shop of Horrors?
Honestly, Little Shop of Horrors was like coming home. This musical has been one of my favorites since I saw it in the theaters back in 1986 when it was released in the movie theaters, the movie version. So I was 11 years old when I saw it in the theater and immediately fell in love. So this is the first opportunity I've had to be involved in the production in any sense. So I was thrilled, A, that we were bringing it here, and B, that I got to be any part of it. Aside from then being told that I could direct it and, like as you said, take the helm of the production.
Terrific. One of the things I really don't know very much about at all is the background of this work. If it first emerged as the musical that it is, I'm pretty sure it has had kind of a gestation in a couple of different stages. So what was this in its original form, and when was that?
In 1960, a black and white movie, Little Shop of Horrors, was released. It was not a musical. It was very much the B-grade, low-budget horror movie that you would expect out of the 1960s. And surprisingly enough, a very young Jack Nicholson is in that movie.
Jack Nicholson,
yes. He plays kind of a dark character.
So and that movie, is that one of those movies that's so bad that it's good? I mean, in kind of unintentionally camp?
I don't think so. No, most people I don't think really know of it, even those that are Little Shop of Horror buffs. I don't think that they even know of it. I didn't even realize that it really existed until I really started doing research for this show, and I was like, well, obviously it had to be based on something. So I watched it. I made my husband watch it. I've made a few friends watch it, and the resounding opinion is this is really bad. But the nice thing about it is that it brought us a musical that is so good.
Wow. So how do we get from this really obscure black and white film from 1960 to this sparkling musical that so many people know and love? What's the journey there?
About 22 years later, in 1982, it was an off-Broadway production. So, and it obviously gained popularity because it did move on to Broadway, and then subsequently became a movie musical in 1986. And that movie musical was actually directed by Frank Oz of Muppet fame.
Ah.
So, and also he has many other directing credits outside of that as well, but it's very appropriate with the plant.
Cool. And what we see in this production at the Theater Guild, is this really close to what people would know from that movie from 30 years ago?
Very close. However, the ending is very different. When the original ending, which is the stage ending, was shown in the theaters, the movie theaters, audiences hated it. So this is actually a different ending, and it was very funny. I was sitting in the audience last weekend, and the show ended, and I heard someone behind me lean over and say, Well, that's not how it's supposed to end. Obviously referencing the movie that they saw in 1986, or, you know, the 1986 movie. So this is the original ending. If you watched the 1960 black and white, black comedy, this is how this movie, or how it had ended.
Cool. So I know at least the bare bones framework of the story. I suspect there are people listening right now who don't know anything about Little Shop of Horrors, except maybe they've seen some still photographs of that huge plant, but have no idea what in the world this is about. So give us at least a sketch of what this intriguing plot is.
Well, the first thing I'll say about it is that it is definitely a dark musical comedy. A lot of people don't think of it, you know, Little Shop of Horrors, and they don't think comedy. It's definitely a comedy. So the story focuses around Seymour, who works in a flower shop down in Skid Row. So down and out area of town. And
not a great place to have a
shop. It's not particularly successful. Well, one day he comes upon this rare and interesting plant. And he brings it to the shop. They put it in the shop window. And all of a sudden, business starts booming because everybody wants to see this plant, which he has named Audrey 2, after the girl in the shop, Audrey. So the problem is the Audrey 2, the plant, is not feeling well. And Seymour is trying to bring it back to life so that they can continue on with the riches it's providing. And he finds out that it eats a very odd thing and has a choice of only one thing, human blood. So he then has to make the choice of, does he continue feeding this plant or does he let it die and the riches dry up along with the plant? So that's where the horror comes in. He makes the choice that as the plant gets bigger and bigger, it's not just drops of blood that it'll settle for. Now it wants human bodies. And so he does in fact start feeding human bodies to the plant.
Wow. So as the plant grows, its does its appetite grow. So, and this sort of shy little milquetoast character Seymour has to somehow deal with this really sort of horrifying situation.
And the fun of it is the plant also, not only does it eat people, it now talks. So the fun, you know, the fun of it is it is kind of a foul-mouthed R&B singing plant. So it's kind of the antithesis of what you would think it would be, which adds to, honestly, the comedy and the fun of the show.
Interesting. I remember from conversations with you back in the spring that one of the great challenges of doing this show is the plant. Or plants, because actually you need more than one, because this plant, Audrey, grows and grows and grows and grows. So tell our listeners a little bit about the odyssey that you went on in terms of sort of checking out the various options that were available to you to put a really great-looking plant or array of plants on the stage.
Yeah, we do have four Audrey 2s throughout the production, and we actually lucked out. There are numerous places that you can rent or borrow them from. Professional companies in Milwaukee have them. There's some companies down in Chicago that rent them out. But we actually lucked out a little bit closer to home. Union Grove High School had done the production a little bit over 10 years ago, and they had their poor little Audrey 2 locked in a crate for the past 10 years. And so we managed to dig her out with the approval of Union Grove High School, and we brought her here. She was a little bit rough for the wear, so I was very lucky. Gary and Linda Cruz were on board to kind of rebuild her and modify her for our use, along with Dawn Van Ness, who's done some wonderful sewing, and they, the three of them just kind of took her and ran, and then we came back, and we had four glorious working plants that we could play with.
Now, I'm curious, I mean, I think a lot of people have seen sort of the iconic image that's from the movie and maybe from Broadway or whatever. But, for instance, the various plants that could be rented, would they all have looked pretty much the same? Or do various productions sort of take this idea and go in whatever direction they want? How wide a variance do you see of Audrey?
For the longest time, they've seemed to look relatively similar. Obviously, in the movie, there's a little bit more, there's a little bit of kind of, I don't think it's CGI, but technology in the 80s, but there was a little bit more special effects to make the mouth move a little clearer, that kind of thing. Obviously, on stage, most of the puppets that I had seen looked very similar. But in researching this show, they've really evolved. The most recent Broadway production, she is absolutely huge. She can move around the entire stage, not just stay in place. Wow. And she grows almost to the size of the proscenium at one point, which is beautiful. The London production, I think Audrey 2 almost looks kind of almost like a slug or alien-esque. They had some fun with the design of her. So there's been some, definitely some changes in her. I'm a traditionalist. I really love the old design of her, and we are closest to that.
Great. That's great. So I know that Rob Cruise, who many people will remember from our Mary Poppins production, plays the shy flower shop guy, Seymour. And someone else who is in the cast but not nearly so visible as Rob is Ian Anderson. Now, do I understand correctly? He's sort of the operator.
He is
of
the
Audrey.
Puppeteer. We have we actually have two people that play Audrey too.
Oh.
We have Ian Anderson, who is the puppeteer for all four puppets, and then we also have Robbie Shaw, who is the voice.
Ah.
So it's very, it would be very difficult for one person to do the puppeteering and the voice in the kind of mechanism that we have.
Right.
So,
so what kind of puppeteering are we talking about?
It goes from a hand puppet to a 6 foot long, and when it opens up, I would guess it's a good 6 foot, 7 foot high puppet.
Wow.
For our last one. So she definitely grows. We're very
And the puppeteering changes accordingly.
Absolutely.
In terms of the mechanism that's involved.
We're very lucky that Ian is as athletic as he is, because it's definitely a challenge for him every night. You know, we had to be very careful during rehearsals to make sure that we're moving fast enough or stopping enough that he could take a break, getting in and out of the costume and taking breaks heat-wise, mobility-wise, that kind of thing. It's definitely a trial. But he did.
Wow.
He was a trooper, and she does come alive on stage, which was just a joy for me. It was very exciting after all these years to have my own little Audrey too. It was very fun.
Cool. They are, of course, central to the story, Seymour and the plant. But there are some other important characters in the show. Tell us who else we need to be sure to watch for.
Well, you have to watch for everybody. Along with this, we have Megan Seeger, who is playing Audrey. Audrey is Seymour's love interest. Yes, she is the human girl Audrey that Audrey 2 is named after. We also have Mr. Mushnick, who is played by Tony Lizaldi. And Mr. Mushnick owns the flower shop that Seymour works at. So it's, you know, it's he's kind of a father figure, but he's more in it for the money. He wants to make sure to keep Seymour around so that the plant stays around. We also have Mike Kishline, who is definitely playing against type. He's playing Orin Scrivello, who is probably the largest, aside from the plant, one of the largest antagonists. And I'm just going to kind of leave it at that for the viewers who don't know, who are coming to see it, who don't know the show. He plays definitely our antagonist, and it's wonderful to watch him play against type. Anybody who knows him, I know a lot of people have come into rehearsals and watched him, and I didn't know he had that in him.
Yeah,
so it's very exciting.
One of the nicest guys in the world, but playing a not-so-nice character
Right. We have the three ladies, Erica Wade, Kate Fisher, and China Chung, who are the trio. It's kind of a Greek chorus. So they kind of, they start out as just part of the action, and then as it goes on, they start making more observations on the action and step outside the action, and then at the end lead the action. Robbie Shaw, as I mentioned, is the voice of Audrey too. He's backstage working very hard, set up with a monitor and a mic to make sure that he's working with Ian. We have Kevin Sustacek, Ryan Simonson, and Rebecca Weaver, who are in the ensemble. And one thing that's really interesting in the original plays and where it's how it's originally written, the person who plays Orin Scrivello, the antagonist, also plays all the ensemble roles. So I decided I wanted to open it up a little bit more, A, to give him more of a break, and B, to give more people an opportunity on stage. So I did open up some ensemble roles. So each one of them are doing a great job playing completely different characters throughout the show as well.
Oh, okay. That's a fun challenge. Describe the musical score. What's it like?
Oh, it's everything.
That's what someone was telling me.
Yeah, I would say that if you had to ask for a style, I would say kind of 1960s R&B, 1960s radio. But there's also the traditional Broadway. I'm sure that people will hear a lot of Alan Menken in it. He's the one who has scored things like Newsies and Disney's Little Mermaid, that kind of thing. You can definitely hear his style in the music. He was the composer.
Oh, okay.
Along with Howard Ashman, who did the lyrics. Famous team. Yeah. So you can hear their style, but it's definitely 1960s R&B, and it takes place around the 1960s. Usually that's where it's set.
Cool. It seems like it has gone quite well. I didn't hear much about rehearsals going till 1 in the morning because of technical nightmares, which is great to hear. But I should think that this is a show that's just full of potential pitfalls in terms of all the technical stuff that has to come together. But it sounds like it's maybe not been a breeze, but it's worked out very well.
It's a relatively, I was actually surprised. I was a little intimidated walking into it, as I always am. Every project I walk into, I have that hesitation of, are we going to get this on stage? But I was actually surprised, and part of it has to do with the crew and the designers that we have here. It's all on them, that it was relatively easy and it was relatively standard. Our biggest challenge was Audrey 2. Which that team, the Audrey 2 crew that I mentioned earlier, did a brilliant job just taking on the project and making it work. And then working with Ian to make sure that it was something that he could manage on stage. So as far as being a director managing this, because of the team that I've worked with, the creative team has just made my job so easy in that respect.
Cool. Last question. We should probably maybe say a word, although we've already kind of broached this topic, but maybe prepare people for not to every last detail, but the kind of things they are going to be seeing, the sort of story that this is. It's not the kind of story you see every day, and it's certainly not Oklahoma or Mary Poppins or anything like it. What would you say to kind of prepare the uninitiated for this?
Well, I would say it's a dark comedy. It is definitely a comedy. We put a PG-13 rating on it just because of a little bit of language. But again, if you would take your son, daughter, aunt, niece, nephew to a PG-13 movie, there would be no issue bringing them here to this production. In some ways, it would be tame in comparison. There is very little gore factor because it is kind of a cartoon comedy. There are definitely dark moments, but it's not out there as far as blood, guts, and gore. It's more suggested than actually shown on stage, which means that, yes, it's dark, a dark comedy, which I love so much, but it's also very, I'm sorry, excuse the pun, palatable for everyone who is coming to see it. So I think it's as an enjoyable ride as it can be for a dark comedy. But I think if people are coming in and, if you're not, and, Oklahoma has its dark moments as well. I think in many ways this show is not as dark as Oklahoma.
Right. That's good point.
So it's a very fun, lighthearted, dark comedy.
There you go. And I've heard nothing but rave reports about it. So I'm honestly, sincerely, really excited to see it. And I hope a lot of other people will seek it out as well. So it's Little Shop of Horrors this weekend. And this is the final weekend of performances at the Racine Theater Guild. And you can go to racinetheater.org or call 633-4218 for more information. And Kara Ernst-Schalk, the director. Thank you, Kara, for making time for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've had on one previous occasion the great pleasure and honor of speaking with best-selling author Anne Brashears. On that occasion, talking about her book, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. She is responsible for other fine books, including The Last Summer of You and Me. But this time we talk about a marvelous new novel, which is called My Name is Memory, based upon the very intriguing notion that all of us come back to Earth again and again and again, many times over, but there are only a very tiny few of us who remember our previous lives. And this particular story revolves around a man who has the memory, this special capacity for remembering his previous lives on Earth. And through each of these lives, he seeks to reconnect with the woman that he loves, a woman with whom he has a very powerful connection. And I am so excited to be able to speak with Anne Brashears about this novel and the beautiful craftsmanship which it represents of this gifted writer. This is published by Riverhead Books. And Anne Brashears, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
So tell us, first of all, does this novel spring out of your own personal reflections and or embrace of the notion of reincarnation, that we perhaps have had previous lives here on Earth before the one that we are currently enjoying? I mean, what does that notion have to do with you personally, if I may ask?
You know, I wouldn't say it is anything like a religious conviction for me, or necessarily a kind of a faith or a belief, but it's more kind of an interest, a fascination, almost from a kind of a poetical or storytelling perspective. I mean, partly I became interested in this because one of my kids, my son Nathaniel, who's now 12, he's the one that I've dedicated this book to. I used to, you know, walk around with him when he was a toddler, and he'd be thinking through all kinds of things. And sometimes he'd say things to me like, when I was alive before, I thought this thing or that thing. And he's quite young. Or when he got a little bit older, he'd say, well, this is my ninth life because I remember being here before. And, you know, I didn't think this is absolutely certainly true and was sort of agog, but it was more, I felt like this was, possibly true, potentially true, interesting. I used to like to sort of talk to him about it without scaring him off the subject. But it got me thinking, you know, what if there was a person who could remember, who carried those memories from life to life over hundreds, even thousands of years? How would that be, and how would such a person relate to the world around him? And particularly, you know, could he find someone to love? Would there be many, or could he really find a soulmate? So that's sort of where all this started for me.
And I think the amount of reflection you've done is very evident in how this book is written and how this story is told. I mean, clearly you have thought a lot about if such a thing were true, and if, in particular, if someone had, at least to some extent, memory of their previous lives, what would that feel like? What would be kind of neat about that? What would be difficult about that? What would that experience be like for such a person? And it is a fascinating notion, and it enriches the book immeasurably.
It was really, really fun and stimulating for me. And, you know, sometimes you think of an idea or a premise for a novel or for a story, and it sort of wears out after a short while, and you think, okay, well, that one's not really worth pursuing. But this one, as you suggest, I felt like it just kept opening up. It just kept bringing me to more and more ideas, not just about, you know, if we were to live again and again, but about life in general, you know, and the importance of being in the present and the importance of living the life that we have. It was a very, very fun, stimulating book to write, as you say, because I felt like there were so many things to reflect on and think of and investigate.
One of the challenges for you as the writer, and to some extent for us as the readers, is the fact that we kind of veer back and forth between basically the present day and our main character in some of his previous lives, some of which go back to ancient times. And
right.
To me, it's this is one of the trickiest things for any author to accomplish, is to write a story that, in a sense, ricochets back and forth without leaving us dizzy, confused, sort of sick of the whole idea. I mean, somehow you have managed to do this in a way that still feels very cohesive. Can you speak a moment about the challenge of this facet of your novel?
Well, I'm so glad that you found it to be cohesive, because I think you're right, that this is a challenge, this sort of structure. at the same time, sometimes I think it can feel sort of freeing to be able to go from one character in one time to another, again, unless it gets too chaotic. But sometimes a book can feel claustrophobic if you feel like you're stuck with one character in one room, you know, on and on and on. Sometimes it's fun to be able to leap around a little bit in history and in different characters' minds. But again, you're right, you do run the risk of it feeling very fragmented. So what I tried to do was basically divide the book between two characters. The first is Daniel, who has the memory. And I wanted him to stay with us in the present, but to tell us stories about his past and the things, you know, the sort of amazing things that have happened to him that he's experienced and that give him, you know, put him in the situation he is today in terms of his enduring love for this young woman and, you know, all the background to that. But I have him tell it as stories. It's not flashback precisely. It's more that he says, you know, I want to tell you about my long life. You know, here was the first thing that happened that seemed very consequential. Here was another thing, and here was another thing. So I try and make it very vivid and set it in historical place, but at the same time, be very strongly in his point of view and in his, you know, storytelling hands. And then the other character, who tells this story is this young woman, Lucy, who's, you know, insofar as anyone is ordinary, she's a pretty ordinary young woman. And little does she know that she shares a similar, gigantic, fascinating past. I mean, you know, many pasts. You know, she's, you know, it's like the tip of the iceberg is what you see, but it goes down so much deeper. And I like the idea that that applies to most all of us. I mean, our souls, in my idea, our souls kind of start at different times, and some last longer than others. Some, you know, live only a life or two, and others go on and on and on and on. So Lucy seems ordinary, but at the same time, you know, the principles of reincarnation apply to her as well. She just doesn't remember them.
Right.
But she and Daniel have, you know, have known each other in the past. So again, she's a more kind of accessible and ordinary character.
Sure. And of course, Daniel, often we see him as a slightly odd duck out of his element. And it's because, of course, he is this extraordinary person, sometimes in the midst of other ordinary people in very ordinary settings, kind of makes you wonder about the people that are sometimes in our lives who seem a little bit different. Is this a possibility that this is what has them seeing the world so differently?
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you know, one of the kind of concepts that I was exploring a little bit as I was trying to open up the world to this idea was, you know, that people who are a little bit odd, who are maybe considered to be, you know, off balance or a little bit crazy, is part of the explanation that they don't have a full memory the way Daniel does, you know, whose memory is very linear and very complete. But are there people who have partial memory, who are remembering bits and pieces here and there and fragments and dreams of old lives? Are they still experiencing, you know, those old emotions and feelings and observations, but just don't know where to put it? So, you know, that was another sort of fun exploration for me.
Absolutely. And at the heart of it is Daniel wrestling with this memory and all of these lives which he has lived and trying to make sense of them. At one point he says, "This is more disorienting than you can know. It's hard enough to maintain your identity through a single life and a single body. Imagine dozens of lives and dozens of bodies and dozens of places among dozens of families, further complicated by dozens of deaths in between. Without my name, my story is no more than a long and haphazard tangle of memories." We find ourselves so intrigued by Daniel and his struggles, not only to maintain identity through all of these lives, but ultimately, of course, to pursue this woman who entrances him so. The book again is My Name is Memory, published by Riverhead Books, yet another fine, fine book from the gifted writer Anne Brushares. Anne Brushares, I thank you for